The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 31st, 2017. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everybody. Good to see you here on this frigid New Year's Eve day. I'm surprised there are as many as there are. I was wondering if anybody would show up with the sub-zero temperatures now that we have, what is it going to be, a high of 6-7 below today or something like that? Anyway, I'm glad you're here. And also for this last day of the year, I thought maybe this would be a good time. Once again, we haven't done this in a while, a Q&A, if you have any questions. It has been quite a year, not that we have to discuss the events of the year. Probably best maybe if we didn't. But if you have any thoughts or questions you might like to discuss, why don't we give that a try? If not, I have a question for you, but I'd just as soon hear from you first. So, anything at all? Yes.
I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about, in practice, whether we anchor the awareness on the breath or sit in open awareness, and what, in my own practice, I've noticed that it almost feels like anchoring the awareness of the breath becomes, questionable. Because my awareness is changing all the time compared to the breath, where I want to focus on or not. So I'm just wondering at what point you just drop that advice with.
Yeah, don't focus on anything. Also, using that term anchoring, you don't need to anchor the breath or anchor your focus on the breath. Just maintain a general awareness. But if you can keep breath in view for a while, because that's something it's always with us, it's continuously going on, whether we think about it or not, we can easily grab hold of it with our thought, and also just bodily we can capture it and breathe in any particular way, hold our breath, whatever we want. But also we can completely forget about it, and there it is. So that's the reason that we invite people to first just take note of the breathing, because it's always there, and yet at the same time you can lose it and it's still there. There's really nothing else quite like this. It belongs both to the subjective, you can immediately control it, and at the same time you can forget about it. You can look at it as an object, and yet it also becomes you, or it seems to be me is what I am, something I'm controlling. You can't do that with anything else. Another bodily function that we have that we can control quite in the same way, that's continuously ongoing like that. You can't grab hold of your heartbeat. You might be able to find it in there. Your liver function, how about that? Do you want to see if you can get hold of that? Pretty difficult, but the breath is right there. So it seems to be me, and yet at the same time, it easily becomes an object. So we just keep kind of a general awareness in that area. Don't focus on it, though. Don't anchor anything. Don't pin anything down. This is very important. Just keep a general awareness of that. But that's a good place to just, if you can stay within the vicinity of awareness of the breath, that's pretty good. And when you realize that you haven't, then just simply come back. If you take hold of some part of the breath, like at the nostrils or whatever, or as you're breathing with the diaphragm, whatever, this is a little bit too much. Yeah. So just keep everything in our practice is general. There's nothing very specific about any of it, and there's no controlling of anything or grabbing hold of anything. Just awareness, just practicing awareness. And breath is this unique, and I really mean that word in its truest sense. There's nothing else like it. This is just to keep the awareness there. in that vicinity. It doesn't have to be limited to that. Thoughts are coming up, sensations in the body, various things, sounds outside the building or in your surroundings. And these things come and go. Maintain a general awareness of whatever is taking place, but don't obsess on it, and don't try to take hold of it. So I don't know, did I answer your question? Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
So if I've heard this correctly, in Zazen, it's like we're doing nothing or not to do anything, and yet there's practice. You know, it seems like practice in Zazen. So could you say a little more about how do we do what we're doing without thinking it's practice or something like that?
Well, you don't have to think it's practice. I mean, but that is what we do. We think, we conceptualize, we grasp, and then we might ask ourselves, well, what am I doing? And we want to supply that answer. Well, I'm practicing, you know. And then we'll keep asking, well, what exactly is practice, you know? And all of this is just insanity. This is crazy. You just realize what you're doing. Are you going to get hold of anything by thinking about it like this? You can always continue to ask questions, you know. This is what really plagues us as human beings. We have these terrific, you know, human minds that can take hold of anything like this. And then the same thing that's why I say with the breath in a meditation, just don't grab hold of anything. Just sit there in awareness. And if thinking happens to come up, well, just be aware that this is what's taking place. You don't need to take hold of the thought. You don't need to follow it, pursue it. You've asked yourself a question. You don't need to, come up with some kind of answer for that or whatever. As if somehow you can actually put something out there that, aha, now that's it. That's the thing that it is. So practice is, of course, whatever you're doing, this is your practice. Like we have that exchange with Yako-san and his teacher Sekito, where Sekito asks him, you know, what are you doing? He's sitting there in meditation. Yako-san is sitting in meditation. Sekito, what are you doing? And he says, I'm not doing anything. And then the teacher tests him on that, because it's so easy for a Zen student just to kind of spit back something that maybe they've heard their teacher say, or other teachers, or they've read it somewhere or whatever, and they think that this is the Zen response. And so we just kick it back without really understanding what you're saying at that point. So Sekito, he just tests him. He says, so you're sitting idly. Yako-san said, if I was sitting idly, I'd be doing something. And, you know, so this isn't about doing anything in particular, but we always are doing, in a sense. But we're not really doing anything in particular. If we think we are, if we conceptualize something here, if we've got a goal in mind and we're reaching for something and we're trying to accomplish something, yeah, well, now we're doing something. But that's not what this is. This is to just sit here in full awareness of what is taking place. And of course, this includes awareness of your mind, your own thoughts. And we're easily lost in the thinking. Now we've lost track of the breath, because that's usually where it is, because we're thinking about something, even though we're still breathing. But, you know, and now we're pursuing this. And we might wake up to the fact, well, I'm not following the breath. And then we get all upset about that, or scold ourselves or whatever. Instead of just, as soon as you realize something like that, just maintain awareness of breath. You don't have to even drop the thinking necessarily if it continues on, but don't feed it. But this is what our practice is. But even if we don't understand this, or we've never pursued this at all, still we practice something. We can practice anger and hatred and any number of things. You know, just getting upset with people, or Well, just anything at all. Something that we desire, we have some idea of some good we want to do. Yeah, we'll turn that into a thing, and then we, pretty soon we're forcing that through and wrestling with it and whatever. Instead of just being fully engaged in the activity of this moment. To the awakened, of course, this includes awareness of totality, wholeness. And then with that, you can begin to realize when your own ego self, your little self here, that wants to do or bring about ends of various kinds or whatever, you can begin to see that engaging in a moment. You also, in time, you can see that if you really, you know, begin to notice this, you can see how that right there is already linked with dukkha. In fact, that's what dukkha is that kind of activity. Okay, and so most of us end up practicing dukkha. But we do it because we don't quite know what we're doing. But this is a practice of awareness. And primarily it is awareness of just what that is, dukkha. And how the ego fits into that and all of that. Our desire to, we feel like we have to do this or do that. We feel like with our practice here, the Zazen I'm speaking of now, is that we have to do it, say just so, and with this, and maybe we're going to accomplish something or get somewhere. Maybe we'll find enlightenment, or at least we can learn to calm down. But this is always a calculating mind that is thinking this way and looking at it this way, and worrying, am I doing this right? Or getting flustered, I can't do this. All of that. Instead of just sitting down, like Yako-san, and doing nothing. Sakito asked him, he said, well then, so what is it that you're not doing? And Yako-san said, even Buddhas don't know. Even the awakened don't know. They don't have ideas about this. But the rest of us, we get ideas. And we want to act out of those. But that's always controlling, manipulating, worrying, or we're driven with maybe some glorious, wonderful idea that we have. But it continuously binds us in confusion. We don't really understand what's going on. Though much of the time we think we do, but actually we don't. If you're still driven by something formed in your mind, or you see it formed in the world, that's confusion. Okay, that's not actually seeing things with real clarity. So I don't know, did I answer you there, Daniel? Or?
Fully.
Fully, okay. Uh-oh. Well, just don't grasp it. If it's truly full, then you won't be able to grasp it. So. Yes?
This might seem like semantics, but that actually was what I was thinking about as a question, which is, if from what you were saying, is there a difference between awareness and full awareness, and is there a spectrum? And what's that mean?
Yeah, well that is a good question. Yeah, there's normally what we think of as awareness is awareness of an object. That's usually what we have in mind. And even if the object is me, you know, the subject, but we can turn ourselves into an object and we start, you know, having questions about that. And we think we're aware of this or that. But awareness itself is, pure awareness is objectless awareness. Okay? And if I were writing that out, I would mark that with a capital A. Instead of small a awareness, that's a conceptual awareness. We could say that pure awareness is also perceptual awareness. It is something we always have. It's impossible to be without perceptual awareness. This is the awareness of a Buddha. It's been called that at times. This is what the awakened are tuned in. It's that kind of awareness. But we all have this. But most of us are taken by the conceptual awareness. When we have an idea of something or other, we see something formed You know, and there's nothing wrong with this or bad about it. You know, we need conceptual awareness. It's just that we will mistake some conceived form here or idea or thought or theory or whatever as, but also objects. These are conceptual as well, conceptual constructs. But we will confuse different things in that territory there for actual awareness, which is the perceptual awareness, which for the most part we ignore that. We're not paying any attention to that, even though that is what we are truly experiencing. And we remain caught in the conceptual, in our ideas about how things are, or how I am, or who I am, or what I am, or what I want, or what should be done, and all that kind of stuff. It's endless. But that's where we remain caught. And again, it isn't that there's something wrong or we shouldn't be doing it. No, but you have to do that. You know, we're not the only ones that do it. You know, animals certainly can do it. You know, but not to the degree that we can. This is why so many people died during that great tsunami back in, when was that, 2004 or something, in the Indian Ocean. You remember that?
Yeah.
And it swept across even over to Africa and to India and Ceylon, Sri Lanka, I should say, where over 200,000 people died. Very few animals died. Well, it's because they're probably, as I said, they can conceptualize. I was able to discern this really by living with some cats for a number of years. And I realized that they, but not to the degree that we do. Just sitting here, we will remain completely caught up in a conceptual world of our own doing and making without even realizing it. Totally unaware even that we're sitting here until all of a sudden the bell rings. Boom, oh, here I am. But this is, you know, this is common for us. We've all experienced this, I'm sure. This sort of thing. And because we're continuously living almost entirely out of the conceptual, oh yeah, well, we think we're related to things, but that's all conceptual construction as well. The things that we'll make of it, you know, we'll see this or that, and we make it into one thing or another, if we're engaged with it at all in any way whatsoever. Otherwise, we kind of just ignore that as well. But that's where we are. You know, and to such a degree that we're not aware of what's going on in our surroundings. And then when there's some huge rumbling under the ocean there or whatever, and all the wildlife that couldn't fly, they started running, getting out of these places. And, you know, there was a group of Japanese tourists who were saved by the elephants that they were riding. It was some kind of tourist thing that they were doing. I was going to say horsebacking, but they were elephant backing, I guess, on these elephants. And the elephants took off. They stopped obeying commands, whatever. They took to the high ground. Nobody knew why. They thought, like, but if the whole herd of elephants was all going, and the people that were on them were saved. Other people would go down to the beach because the ocean had left. Now there's all kinds of shells and things that they could go. They have no idea the ocean has left because there's going to be this huge tsunami coming in. That's why the ocean departed. If you're ever by the ocean and it leaves, get out of there. Because the ocean will come back. But this is what happens. We're so caught up in our busy minds. We don't notice the shift, the change in the earth, in the atmosphere, whatever might be happening here. Because we're so busy with our thinking, with our jabbering to ourselves and to each other. But the other animals, they're kind of tuned. They're not that busy in their minds, you know, as we are. I'm guessing. This is my own theory. I'm not having an animal mind. How would I know for sure? But it seems to me that this would be the case. Because when I heard this, I thought, well, that's interesting. And, of course, we think, well, the animals have these extra senses and stuff. Well, not necessarily. we have this extra sense of where we can conceptualize to such a degree that we immerse ourselves in it. We leave ourselves in that continuously. And being tuned in very little to the actual perceptual experience of what's taking place around us. So, this is what we do. And so these are two kinds of awarenesses. There's the perceptual, and then there's the conceptual. And part of what it is that we can learn here is finally wake up to the fact that we are having this actual direct, immediate, direct perceptual experience of reality. There's enlightenment in that. You will see what is really taking place there. But it's only a matter that we ignore this. And we ignore it because we are so distracted by the stuff that we think. Whether it's abstract stuff or actual physical things that are taking place in the environment around us, whatever it is. But that's where we're caught. And not really tuned in to what is actually going on here. So that's the pure awareness. Again, this pure awareness isn't better than conceptual awareness or whatever. Conceptual awareness is an aspect of awareness, pure awareness. In the pure awareness, it isn't being, we're not distracted by the things that are there within the awareness. So I don't know, does that make any sense at all? Or did I answer the question? Yeah. And so like sitting in our meditation again, with all the conceptual awareness that is taking place, the ordinary awareness, the intellectual awareness, but it's not just necessarily intellectual or whatever, as we commonly might use that word. But it's just caught up in the world of formed things, not just objects out there, but thoughts and feelings and sensations and things that we're experiencing as well. And then thoughts that we might lay on top of that, maybe worrying about this or trying to bring about that or whatever. All of that. What our practice is to become aware of what's going on with that and realize that there's a backdrop to all of this that we're oblivious to. And we can learn to settle down with that. You don't need to do anything about all this distraction, all that noise that's going on in the mind. Just be aware that that's taking place. Once we start to become aware that that's what's going on, and that isn't the mind of an awakened person, that's the mind of somebody who's very taken by the phantom, because most of it is just imaginary, made up kind of stuff. Most of it. But we start to become aware of what we're doing and how we're caught with that. And with that, we can be, the mind just quite by itself, because there's no way to control this or bring it about, but the mind will begin to settle down. And that's getting into our practice then. That's what this practice is about. We become like Yaku-san, where he says, I'm not doing anything. There might be, thoughts that come up, feelings, whatever, sensation. They'll come up but that's far different than just this, which is going on continuously. But it's all a matter of awareness. That's why the Buddha said when he was asked, if he could sum up his teaching in a single word, he said, awareness. That's what this practice is. But just so you know, this isn't referring to awareness of particularness, of this and that, of something you need to become aware of. Getting the right idea. Is an awakened one, are they aware of something that I'm not aware of? No. You're aware of this too. It's a background awareness. Again, like they say, using the example of the animals, because their minds probably aren't quite as busy, insanely busy as because we have these powerful human minds, which are incredible, they're wonderful. But we got to start to learn what this means, and it's creating all of this kind of stuff. We can let that go. We start to become aware of this and settle back down into this. Gain that kind of sensitivity. Well, we actually have it. It's just that, hey, we can learn to stop ignoring it. Stop making all the sound over it that we don't notice, you know, our participation here in the environment. I caught this thing on the radio yesterday. I didn't really listen to it. It was on Minnesota Public Radio. And I don't even know why I turned it on. I was actually going to start getting ready to come over here for something. And maybe I was checking out the weather, I don't know. But I had the radio on and briefly, and I don't really know what the story was, but apparently it was about this guy who, I guess he likes to live like an animal. And so at different times in his life, he'll single out an animal. And I think, what was the animal? They were talking about a badger. So he would kind of observe and study the badger. And so he ended up living kind of like the way a badger would. he'd do this for a few months or something. Did anybody hear this? I didn't hear the whole thing anyway. But what I heard was rather interesting. At first I thought, well, this is crazy, you know. But then they were interviewing the guy, and then he had built himself like a human-sized badger burrow, you know. The badgers, they live underground, you know. And so he was there. But then he talked about, and then also badgers. Was it a badger? I think it was a badger. The badgers, they have very poor eyesight. So, and also he was, I guess, training his young son to live like a badger with him. And anyway, because the badger can't see very well, they blinded them, they put, you know, what do you call it, blinders on, what do you call those? Anyway, over the eyes. So they couldn't see. And he talked about how you really get tuned into the smell. And like for a badger, of course, their nose is close to the ground and all of this. And then he talked about how, and this is about the point where I had to go and I turned off the radio, but I caught at least this much, but this was fascinating. It's enough to make me almost want to stay to hear this out. But he talked about how, like, after a rain, the earth just comes alive. What was the word? It just bursts forth with this smell. The smells are just incredible. You know, just the sticks and the moss and the leaves and the, you know, along the ground, that sort of thing. It just comes forth with this. And, of course, this was the world of the badger. See, it's not so caught up with the visual, not so caught up with the thought. There's probably thinking of some sort, maybe, going on, but probably quite still and quiet compared to ours for a badger. So really tuned in with the nose. Also, I can think of a dog. Just think of how the world is to a dog. Of course, we drag dogs into our domesticated life here, and so it's kind of a distorted thing. But still, they're dogs, you know, and they live out of the smell, you know, their nose, you know. That's their dominant sense, not the eyes like us, and not the churning human mind that keeps cranking away like that. So this is all quite interesting, I thought anyway. But we can tune in to these sorts of things to the degree that we're completely caught up in our minds, lost in our minds. You know, we're not even making use of the senses that we do have. You know, maybe too reliant on the eyes. I don't know. I don't want to say that really. But there's far more at our disposal, and through awareness we can find that. So I don't know. I guess I don't have any more thoughts on that. But I think it's kind of the reason I guess I brought that up is because it's just to give an example of a way that we can kind of shift out of the way that we. I'm not saying we should start living like badgers. I find that kind of silly in a way. I mean, we're human, so I'm not inviting us to go out and start living in a badger burrow. But it is a matter of we start to realize that how much is available to us that we completely ignore because of our jabbering minds. Most of which going on in our minds is worthless. Worthless. But it does have some value. I mean, some of it. I mean, we have to think. We have to get ideas and conceptualize and all this. But we spend so much of it in just nonsense. And our life, the world, kind of passes us by. Yaka-san sitting there, not doing anything, but experiencing totality. You know, which we all are. But most of us tune it out. And what we don't realize too, in the process of doing that, we frighten ourselves, we disturb ourselves, we become upset in all sorts of ways. And we're oblivious to it. We're not paying attention. So our practice, our way is to just slow down and realize when you're starting to, you know, overdo it there with the chasing mind. The other thing too is that the backdrop of the world just really starts coming up. Like noticing how after a rain, look, the smells are all so vibrant and alive and they intensify and all this. As a human being, we can notice this. You probably have noticed it, but then we don't really take that into account, and the next thing you know, we're back to just totally ignoring it. Thich Nhat Hanh, when I spent a little bit of time with him, and I remember he talked about how when we're walking on the earth, he would do these walking meditations and things. But he talked about how when we're walking on the earth and really feeling the earth beneath your feet, or here in the Kinyan, the walking meditation that we do, to really be present with it. You're feeling the floor. And this feeling of the floor is the floor. This is you. This is life. This is it. It's this feeling. Don't think about it. I'm talking. I'm using words like feeling and floor and all that. But wordlessly paying attention, particularly if we are engaged in a meditation of walking, say. But even there, you know, we can be so busy. We're walking, we don't quite know what we're doing, and the mind is jabbering, even as we're walking. Well, we do this all the time, over and over and over again. But at some point, we have to kind of slow down and realize what this practice is and what it's inviting us to do. And the richness that comes with that, because of the whole world comes up to it. And the smells in the air, whatever. The vibrations under the ocean. You know, when the tsunami is beginning to, you know, rise up out there at sea that we don't notice yet. You know, but we could. So anyway, but I've gone enough with this. You're welcome. Anything else? Yeah.
Can I just share a story that kind of maybe that's what you're talking
about? Sure.
About two and a half decades ago, I was in a Chichikase Nango in Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And during a 12-month cycle, they have two big celebrations. One I don't recall the name of, the other one is the Baile del Venado, which is the deer dance. And
The what dance?
Deer dance.
Oh, deer, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's part of a larger celebration.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess a Western anthropologist might describe what the indigenous Indian people do there is animistic. They have a strong connection to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And during this celebration, there's this principal mask maker that they go and rent masks from. And the masks are like monos, monkeys, deer, donkeys, all kinds of different animals. And 3 days prior to the dance, they start fasting. and some even in Jeff's hallucinogens from nature like POD or other types of psychotropic natural drugs that arise in nature. But the point is that when the dance actually comes around and they put the mask on, that they will have fully become animistically this creature, and they will carry on for 24, 48, 72 hours without sleep, just fully becoming this crow, this deer, this monkey. You know, it's really quite fascinating to watch. But I thought it kind of connected to what this guy, in his own way, was doing with this thing with the badger. Something very deep-seated. You know, if you look at it as an outsider, it might seem very bizarre and strange, but this is something they practiced centuries before pre-Columbian era. You know?
So, yeah. Well, of course, we also have evidence from the caves, like was it Lascaux? Is that the name? Like in France, where 30,000 years ago, 35,000 years ago, where they have the paintings on the walls of the caves of, you know, you'd see people with animal skins on them and heads and things, you know.
And the true reasoning or knowledge of why they do that, may really have been lost on what our understanding of it is today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can hypothesize or something, but you know, really know the depth of you know,
no.
why they're doing it, and the necessity for it.
Yeah. I think all we can do, really, is just let go of any ideas that we might have. I remember when I first saw these things as a, young teenager, adolescent, or whatever, and I was fascinated by the cave paintings and that kind of stuff. And it was just so primitive, but it was just this incredible thing. And I remember wondering about these people and what was going on in their minds. What were they? But eventually I started to realize, and I might have been making up explanations for myself. And I was also reading, anthropologists, whatever, that would study these things, and they'd have their various theories and things, you know. But by and by, after a time, I just kind of started dropping the desire to get hold of, you know, any idea, because I realized whatever idea or theory I might have about who these people were and what they were thinking, I don't know. It's powerful enough just to see this and to let the rest, just to kind of let it go. But also I think we can find within ourselves, you know, something that is like that. Again, I don't mean like we should now make a badger burrow and do stuff like this. But still, we can tune into this to realize that how connected we are to the world around us, and not just to the animals and the plants, all of this, you know, but really, you know, to everything. This really is our life, even to the touch of the floor beneath the foot, you know. And again, it's through our just continuously and being utterly caught up in the conceptual all the time. We have no idea to the degree to which we are caught in this way. To really start tuning into this, noticing this, and then letting this drop away. You know, it doesn't have to drop away, and in fact, it won't drop away completely, and it probably shouldn't. We need the conceptual, but it's just over-exercised in us, you know, particularly us Western people here, I think. Probably even more so now that we have all these gadgets and gizmos that can really, you know, carry us away. Even though we're walking along the lake, I see this when I'm on my walks, you know, and people are just, you know, they'll even come 2x2 and 3x3 or whatever, and they're all. But we're just so used to being so tuned out. You know, so it's a matter, I think, of just being aware of these things, being aware of how people seem to have acted, and you know, in the past, and all these kinds of things. Just live with the awareness of just that. When we start to theorize about it, and to try to explain it to ourselves and what's going on, that's okay. If you really have to in some limited way, yeah, be very careful there, though. But don't ever get the idea that you actually know. That you know the mind of even the contemporaries, people living now today in Guatemala. And what exactly is their mind? You'd have to be born in that culture, perhaps. But even there, this person and that person, both born in that culture, carrying on in their own way. Even there, they can't really understand what's going on in the mind of the other. But it would make a lot more sense for them to do that than, say, for us now. Of course, we'll see stuff like that, and we might be caught by it, and then we want to imitate that. Well, no, I think it's best that we tune into what are we here? Settle down with that. Wake up to this. And, don't try to imitate somebody else. I always felt I was kind of fortunate in a way that I had a Japanese teacher, who even if I wanted to imitate him, I couldn't. I mean, he was just... And if I did, I never did, but if I did, it would be so silly, so stupid, so foolish, But I wanted to know what it is that he sees, and then without giving it any more thought than that, realizing that whatever it is I understand from this, I will just naturally express it in my own way, I never give any thought to how it is that I'm doing or speaking or acting or walking or whatever. I don't care. That's not my interest. My interest is just to be in this practice, in this moment. That's where the richness of life is, and just actually living it out. But without, not in the conceptual modeled construction of it in your mind. I mean, that's nothing. It's brittle, and it's... easily broken and disturbed and all of that. We all have rich lives right here. We need to wake up to them, that's all. Yes?
Why do we meditate with dark robes on?
Yeah, well, white, if it isn't a real... hot white or a flat, but a bright white. That's pretty bright there. And that's fine. Although I'm not criticizing you, and that would be perfectly fine. I don't have any, and I don't know why I don't make it a rule that we have to wear dark clothes, but I always wear dark clothes maybe, and Norm does, and so maybe people are picking up on that. But I do say this when I'm giving meditation instruction, that we do avoid bright clothes. White really isn't quite an issue, though that is a kind of a bright white. But but I don't mean. But I really don't mean it in any kind of criticism. And but a bright pink or green or orange or something like this, you might want to avoid that. And the reason is. Because it'll catch the eye, Maybe not yours because you're wearing it, but for other people, it's a distraction. And in that way, so to get closer to the more subdued colors, earth tones, and things like this, but it's just for that reason alone to just kind of keep the eye settled, So we avoid. The extremes and that sort of thing, but I don't have any real, hard and fast rule about this here. Though it is sort of a, suggestion. I remember Thich Nhat Hanh too. He asked me when I was there with him, and then he said, in those days I was wearing my robes and that, but because I was a priest there when I went to see him. But anyway, but he asked me. He said, "Why do you wear black?" He said. And he said, "That's a Japanese color." Of course, I'm seeing my teacher, and we have the black zafus and things here. And he said, "That's Japanese." He said, "You're American." He said, "Maybe it should be you should wear blue." He said. And I said, oh, like blue jeans, I said, you know. And yeah, so there's no particular rule or reason to it, but there is that other factor of, you know, just kind of avoid something that's bright and eye-catching in that way. Because just kind of reflect on, well, what is the practice that we do? Well, it is to settle the mind. So there's certain kinds of sounds and things that could be, you know, disturbing, and colors and things of this sort. So we just see if we can kind of avoid those things, you know. But I wouldn't obsess on it, you know, or get upset or anything else, you know. So everything's allowed. But if there is something that's truly distracting, you know, then I might, privately, I might just step up to somebody. Like there was one fellow here a long time ago now, and but it was at a session, and which is a, you know, several days of just meditating, basically. And I remember that in that, was it in the morning when I came in or whatever, I don't remember, but when I came in the door here, and he was, in those days, the sitting arrangement is a little different than what I have now, but he was sitting right here in front of me as I came in. So I'm looking at the back of this fellow. And it was kind of like a bright yellow shirt, and on the back it said, "Gotta have Java." And bong, and it just caught the eye like that, you know. This is at a session, you know. So we're all just settling down. So I just mentioned to him, you know, when I had a chance to, and I said, maybe I told Eno, just let him know that he shouldn't wear that shirt. But that was the only reason. So we also, we take down, like we cover the, do we cover the books on it? Well, you can't get close to the books in the library because we have other stuff there during a session, but we cover the bulletin boards, take down the clock, stuff like that, because these are all kind of distractions. So we're just kind of assisting us, you know, in letting the mind not get hooked on various things that we're easily drawn to or we get caught by, you know. So reading something, or again, the bright sounds or colors or whatever. So we just kind of avoid that, that's all. This isn't about banning any of it, we're tuning it out, because you can't do that either. You know, we're always tuned into the world. But Dogen said it very well in his Fukan Zazengi, where he says, you know, for Sanzen, which means our meditation carried out properly, he said a quiet room is suitable. You know, avoid all this, avoid all distractions and affairs, or whatever, cease all affairs, sees all movements of the conscious mind, this sort of thing. Just settling down. It's suitable. It's not absolutely required. We're not, you know, but it's suitable. So let's go in this direction, just to make things a little settled and quiet. So that's kind of what's behind that, really. Anything else? Well, it is New Year's now. It's sweeping toward us at I don't know how many hundreds of miles an hour, but it's in the world right now, and it's coming toward us. So, I remember my little granddaughter one time. Ooh, they live in Oregon, and we were on the phone, and Dan, you know, was you know, her dad. We were on the phone, but then Ada got on the phone too a little bit there, and then. Somehow, I don't know, I just mentioned that it was dark outside. I don't know how the conversation went, but I just mentioned it was like dark outside the window or whatever. I couldn't see outside or whatever. But it was still daylight where they were. And I remember Ada, my little granddaughter, she looks at her dad and she says, "Where is he?" And she's still too young for any of us to explain the sweeping shadow of the earth, you know, was sweeping toward her. And in a couple hours, it'll be dark there too. But anyway, yeah. I gave them a globe now, her and her little brother, last summer. I was going to explain the eclipse to them a little bit. But anyway, now they have a globe, and so she's learning about stuff like that. Anyway, I don't mean to go on about that. But I just want to say, yes, so New Year's is approaching, and so I just want to say Happy New Year to everybody. And I guess we can break now. If there's no other question,
what was your question for us? Oh, you not want to get into that.
Well, at this point, no, because it would have filled the hour. We'd have to take another hour at least. At this point, I think I'll leave it. Yeah. Never mind. I'm tempted to tell you, but unless we could discuss it a little bit, it might be best not to. Yeah, I'll leave it for next year. There you go. So, okay. We're just sweeping toward us even as we sit here now. So, okay, well, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.